friends, neighbors, and good people everywhere. Thank you for tuning in to the Classic English Literature Podcast, where rhyme gets its reason. Today is the first of two episodes on the Elizabethan poet and factotum Edmund Spenser. The first here will focus on his works of lyric poetry, and the second will take as its subject his sprawling epic poem, The Faerie Queen. And I do mean sprawling, ladies and gentlemen. The Faerie Queen stretches, spreads, rambles, extends, straddles, lounges, and indeed from time to time lolls. But more on that next time. For now, might I remind you that my email is classicenglishliterature, that's all one word, classicenglishliterature@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you, your questions, your comments, your suggestions, and of course your approbations. I confess I'm a bit fragile, and so I will be shattered by criticisms, but I will do my level best to improve where you find me wanting. That I swear. You can follow me on all the Insta-Twit FaceTalk platforms. Please like all my posts. Like I said, I'm fragile. Please post a positive review on your podcast platform. That will really help the show's audience grow. And if you feel so moved, you can make a financial contribution by clicking the Support the Show button. Now, I'm not looking to make any money on this podcast. I'm just looking for a little help with the expenses, so thank you very much. On the last full episode of the show, we looked at Sir Philip Sidney, particularly in light of what Castiglione called sprezzatura, that ability to make the difficult and complex seem casual or blasé. Like, how to appear cool, really. Sprezzatura is how to appear cool, to be awesome without looking like you're trying to be awesome. That's cool. Today's writer, however, tried very, very hard. He intentionally set out to be a great, transformative poet, and he didn't give a fly's fart in a fountain about looking cool. Where Sidney appeared insouciant, Edmund Spenser strove. A lot of the early modern poetry we've looked at so far has been the pastime of courtiers. And that's a fairly slim sample of the population when you come to think of it. Of course, court aristos are the only ones with the formal education and the free time to give to the frivolity of verse. The lower and middling sorts are too busy trying to get food and trying not to get the plague. And Spenser was of that lower and middling sort, middle-class fella. Born around 1552, got a good education by enrolling as a sizar at Cambridge, that is, an impoverished scholar. Poor kid. While there, however, he took a great interest in poetic theory and versification. On the less savory side, his first attempts at poetry were virulently anti-Catholic. But eventually he landed a gig as the secretary to the Earl of Leicester. Yes, Queen Bess's alleged boyfriend. But he never found enough favor with Her Majesty to officially join the court. He later went to Ireland, where he became a minor official in the colonial apparatus. He continued to heap scorn and opprobrium on the Catholics, and eventually lost his infant son during an anti-colonial uprising in Munster, which probably did nothing to improve his attitude toward the native people. Spenser's first major work is a collection of pastoral poems called The Shepherd's Calendar. We've spoken of pastoral poetry a few times here on the potty, but for those just tuning in, pastoral poetry depicts an idealized rural landscape and lifestyle. Pastorals go all the way back to the Greek Theocritus of the 3rd century BCE and became a standard genre in the classical period. Shepherds feature prominently. The term pastoral comes from the Latin for shepherd. That's why we call ministers pastors as well, by the way. And you know, shepherding is the actual world's oldest profession, isn't it? Herding, I mean, I imagine the solitude of such a vocation was also a great impetus to that other oldest profession, much to the relief of the sheep. Early modern pastorals exhibit a nostalgia for a simple country life, and this is in reaction to the increasing urbanization of 16th century societies. Common concerns of such poetry include love, well, seduction, mainly, the value of poetry, mourning and death, the corrupt city and the court over against the purity of the country. And frequently, poets would satirize politics, using the voices of the shepherds to poke fun at easily recognizable prominent persons. Spenser's Shepherd's Calendar is important for a number of reasons. Firstly, there was a somewhat implicit understanding that, based on the Virgilian model, if one intended to be a serious poet, one must submit to something of a public apprenticeship. Pastoral poetry was the formal declaration of that intention. You produced some pastorals, you worked your way up through some love poetry, then through tragedy, let's say, and finally you produced your epic. So, by whipping the Shepherd's Calendar out in 1579, Spenser makes his ambitions known. He will be a new great poet. And I want to call attention to the new there. We'll see that Spenser is quite a paradoxical writer in many ways. He's innovative and traditional. He's continental and nativist. For instance, and this is probably among the things most commented upon concerning Spenser, he uses a consciously archaic form of English. He emulates what he understands as medieval language, eschewing as often as he can diction with classical roots in favor of a quote-unquote native word. He uses old words that have fallen out of fashion, like ache for also or mickle for much or great. And quite apart from ornamentation, he does so in a conscious effort to establish English's bona fides, as it were. 16th century England is a country on the rise. It's established its religious independence from Rome, it's made some gains in colonial expansion, and it has thwarted a major Spanish invasion. Such a waxing power requires a language equal to the great cultural languages, and Spenser saw that lying in the language of Chaucer, quote, the lodestar of our language. In fact, Spenser begins the Shepherd's Calendar with a kind of envoy whose first line, quote, go, little book, thyself present as child whose parent is unkent. This echoes Chaucer's introduction to his own Troilus and Crusade. Quote, go, little book, go, little mine tragedy. And the word unkent, by the way, in Spenser here means unknown. It's a form of the Anglo-Saxon verb to ken, which means to understand. So even in looking back, Spenser looks forward. The Shepherd's Calendar is quite deftly structured. There's a plan here, right? So it contains 12 poems, one for each month, a calendar. So while each poem can stand on its own, collectively they form an organic whole, the turning of the seasons, the turning of the year. Interesting bit of structural trivia. Spenser begins the Shepherd's Calendar in January, and he ends it in December. And he does so because he wants the poem to begin and end in the wintertime, with all winter's connotations, right? Big deal, you say. That's how calendars work. But here's the thing. Back in the day, the year was taken to begin in March, round about spring. So Spenser's making a symbolic move here. Each poem is written in a different meter. And of those 12, actually 13, meters, only 3 or 4 were in common use at the time, so Spenser invents most of the scansion here. Each pastoral is introduced with a gloss by someone called E.K., which summarizes the poem to follow. Now, who is E.K.? I'm not sure I want to open that can of worms. The tinfoil hat people have so many theories and they're so easily excited. Some say that E.K. is Edmund Kirk, a fellow sizar at Cambridge. Others posit Gabriel Harvey. He was a college buddy who was mentioned in the dedicatory epistle. Still others say it's Spencer himself. And I like that idea because some of the glosses are wrong. They're off the mark. It's kind of interesting to think that Spencer's got a little bit of a mind screw layer going on in this poem, huh? Spencer himself appears in the poems in an allegorized figure he calls Colin Clout, one of the shepherds, a lover and a poet. You may wish to know that Colin Clout is a folk character originally created by John Skelton about 100 years earlier. Now, Spencer says, quote, "Under which name this poet secretly shadoweth himself, as sometime did Virgil under the name Tityrus." Hardly a secret when you tell us, but in the poem that begins the cycle, called January, it's written in 6-line pentameter stanzas rhyming ABABCC, Colin laments his unrequited love for the indifferent Rosalind, her coldness fitting for the bitter winter. He breaks his oaten pipe, that is, the metaphor for his poetry, and he collapses in despair. The poem April records the dialogue of two shepherds, Hobbinol and Tenot, who discuss Colin's recent dearth of poetry. Hobbinol laments, quote, "Shepherd's delights he doeth them all forswear, his pleasant pipe which made us merriment. He willfully hath broke and doth forbear his wonted songs wherein he all outwent." Tenot then convinces Hobbinol to sing one of Colin's songs, and Hobbinol obliges with a lay in praise of Queen Elizabeth, quote, "Fair Eliza, queen of shepherds all." The dialogue Spencer writes in iambic pentameter, but for the lay he switches to kind of a complex stanza form. It's 9 lines. The first 4 alternate iambic pentameter and dimeter. Then we get 2 more pentameter lines, 2 dimeter lines, and finally a tetrameter. The rhyme scheme is ABABCCDDC. The effect is really quite dance-like. The short lines feel like staccato steps clipping the long, languid lines. Let's look at October, which many critics think is the most important entry in the calendar. 2 other shepherds, Cuddy and Piers, discuss the value of poetry. Piers tries to encourage his dejected friend, who used to be quite prolific, and who cheered everyone with his poems. Cuddy says that's all past now, there's no point in writing poetry anymore. Now, it's easy to see this dialogue as, in some way, Spencer's debate with himself about the value of a poetic career. And he's having this debate with himself at the beginning of his career. Piers seems very lofty. He believes that poetry can, quote, "restrain the lust of lawless youth with good advice." That is, as Sidney had argued, poetry is the grace of virtuous instruction. Piers believes in divine inspiration, quote, "thy muse display her fluttering wing." And he urges his friend to abandon the pastoral ditties and aspire to heroic verse. Quote, "Abandon then the base and viler clown. Lift up thyself out of the lowly dust and sing of bloody Mars, of wars, of jousts. Turn thee to those that wield the awful crown, to doubted knights whose woundless armor rusts and helms unbruised waxen daily brown." Perhaps, suggests Piers, Cuddy could take Queen Elizabeth herself, or her favorite, the Earl of Leicester, as his subjects. Quote, whither thou list in fair Eliza rest, or if thee please in bigger notes to sing, advance the worthy whom she loveth best, that first the white bear to the stake did bring. But Cuddy is more practical, he's more down to earth. Despite the fact that E.K. calls him, quote, the perfect pattern of a poet, kind of feels like Piers is more the pattern, especially given his advice about the proper hierarchy of poetry, the appropriate subjects and ways of securing patronage. But Cuddy notes that he's no better off for his poetic work. Poetry is too transitory. He gains nothing by it. Quote, the dapper ditties that I wont devise to fade a youth's fancy and the flocking fry delight in much. What I the bet for thy? They have the pleasure, I a slender prize. I bait the bush, the birds to them do fly. What good thereof to Cuddy can arise? All his effort flies to others. He works, they enjoy. Furthermore, Cuddy argues that there are no virtuous heroes nowadays and no wealthy patrons willing to pay to hear about them. Quote, but after virtue gan for age to stoop, and mighty manhood brought a bed of ease. All a poet can do in these decadent times is satirize the present folly. And then he snipes, quote, for Colin fittest such famous flight to scan. He, were he not with love so ill bedight, would mount as high and sing as sota as swan. Oh, if only our friend Colin Clout weren't so addle-pated in love, he might be able to write some truly righteous verse. Okay. If we accept my little notion that October is Spencer's debating with himself about the purpose of the poet's craft, things just got really crowded. Remember, Colin is, in the dramatic structure of the Shepherd's Calendar, Spencer himself, so the author seems to be chastising himself for just not getting on with it. That line feels to me like Spencer dismissing the whole point of the October poem. Piers encourages, Cuddy whines, Colin daydreams. And oh, you know, if we want to think of E.K., the glosser, as another Spencer avatar, he doesn't even get his own argument straight. Now, this is not the typical reading of the poem, but I think such a meta angle is actually kind of fun. Besides, all the stuff here really offers a good anticipation of Spencer's actual poetic career. He starts with the pastorals. He'll move on to some love poems, and we'll get to those in a second. And then he writes his great heroic epic, The Faerie Queen, about good Queen Bess herself. Just like Pierre said. So, young Edmund moves on to his love poems, most famous of which belong to his cycle of 89 sonnets called Amoretti, which means little loves or little intimacies. Like Petrarch's Canzonieri, Amoretti sounds like they're delicious, right? And like you stop into a panateria, you order a cappuccino and two Amoretti. I'm imagining some kind of light pastry with buttered almonds and cream. Any of you out there are pastry chefs, come up with something, send them to me in the clubhouse. In the early 1590s, a middle-aged Spencer fell to swooning and a-wooing for young Elizabeth Boyle. And in 1594, their connubial bliss was consummated. Amoretti is a record of their courtship and marriage. And here, too, Spencer does a bit of subtle innovating. Now, there's no shortage of Renaissance sonnet cycles. We've mentioned a couple already, and there will be more. Amoretti is unusual in that the courtship here, it's successful, and the love is fulfilled. Like, we don't get that in the old medieval courtly love verses that the sonnets developed from, and we don't get that from Sir Philip Sidney's Astrophil and Stella. In fact, he gives away the broken hearts in the very title. But Spencer gets his Beatrice, his Laura, his Stella. Bravo, man. There also seems to be a much closer relationship between poet and speaker in the Amoretti. We get the almost proto-romanticist sense that Spenser actually is the speaker of these poems, and not merely a metafictional projection as in Sidney or Petrarch. Now, none of this is to say that there is no drama or tension in the Amoretti sonnets. It is, after a fashion, a narrative, and narrative requires conflict. So, the cycle begins with Spenser's love being rejected by Elizabeth, but in the fullness of time, she relents and returns his love. Hooray! Ah, but summat gang aglay, and she once again turns against him. Boy meets girl, boy gets girl, girl gets angry at boy. How will it all turn out? Patience, dear listener, patience. Well, it will turn out well. Sonnet 1 giddily anticipates the joy that the pages and the lines and the rhymes will have when the poet's beloved reads them. But by Sonnet 10, he is cursing the, quote, unrighteous lord of love for tormenting him, allowing her to make, quote, my pain her sport. In Sonnet 22, during the season of Lent, that time of repentance, he decides that he will build his beloved, metaphorically, of course, quote, an altar to appease her ire, on which, quote, my heart will sacrifice. Sonnet 28 raises his expectations, quote, give me great hope of your relenting mind. But 29 confesses that she's misunderstood him, treating his, quote, simple meaning with disdainful scorn. The ups and downs continue, but in the final sonnet, number 89, the credits roll rather bleakly. The final couplet reads, quote, dark is my day, whiles her fair light I miss, and dead my life that wants such lively bliss. Oh, old man, you said it worked out well. This doesn't seem like a rom-com ending. Indeed, no, it doesn't. And perhaps I overstated when I implied a happy ending. Yes, they do get together and wed and, well, you know. But underneath all the Amoretti is this ticking time bomb. It haunts several of the sonnets and gives them not only their drama, but their ambiguity. It's mortality, the fact of death. Sonnet 13 offers an early example. The beloved, quote, looking on the earth whence she was born, her mind remembereth her mortality. Whatso is fairest shall to earth return. But that same lofty countenance seemeth to scorn base thing, and think of how she to heaven may climb. There's a haughty defiance in Elizabeth, but Spenser thinks he can exploit it to win her, for, quote, yet lowly still vouchsafe to look on me, such lowliness as shall make you lofty be. In other words, though I am lowly and base, yet I have the means by which to grant you the immortality you deserve. And that is my verse. Sonnet 72 also offers the contrast between the, quote, burden of mortality and sovereign beauty. And again, Spenser believes he can resolve that contrast. His mind, quote, nethinks of other heaven, but how it might her heart's desire with most contentment please. Heart need not wish none other happiness, but here on earth to have such heaven's bliss. Note that heaven is kind of desacralized here. It's not a theological metaphor or proposition. It's very earthly. It's palpable, sensual. Now, my favorite sonnet in Amoretti is probably the most famous one, but it does a lovely job of punching the bruise. That is, it's a great way of making my point yet again. I'm going to quote this one in its entirety because I really like it. One day I wrote her name upon the strand, but came the waves and washed it away. Again I wrote it with a second hand, but came the tide and made my pains his prey. vain man, said she, that dost in vain assay a mortal thing so to immortalize. For I myself shall like to this decay, and ache my name be wiped out likewise. Not so, quoth I, let baser things devise to die in dust, but you shall live by fame. My verse your virtues rare shall eternize, and in the heavens write your glorious name. Where when as death shall all the world subdue, our love shall live and later life renew. Oh, I just love that. I do. Okay, look, here's the story. Edmund and his lady love, Elizabeth, are walking along the beach. And in what seems to me an innocently romantic gesture, he writes her name in the sand. But a wave comes and washes it away. So he does it again. And the same thing happens. Now, the more perspicacious among you might ask, why doesn't he just walk further up the beach? Because then he wouldn't be able to make his cool point. She says, dummy, you can't make me immortal. I'm going to get washed away someday just like my name here. And she makes a lovely pun on the word vain, exploiting both its meaning of conceited or narcissistic and its meaning of futile. But in the sonnet's volta, he says, nuh-uh, let low base creatures die in dust. My poetry will write your name in the heavens. And even when all life on earth is extinguished, our love will live in these lines and will bring life back. Boom. But note that he says heavens again, not as a celestial realm, but as the sky. We're on earth. And base things can, quote, die in dust, he says. There is no heaven in the afterlife sense. We return to the dust of the earth, just as in Genesis and as in Sonnet 13. Spenser here portrays immortality as conferred by the humanistic effort of art. This poem posits humanity as the imago Dei, the image of God, creator with a small c. Vain man indeed. Now, it's easy for the casual reader to note the sniping of Elizabeth the Beloved in many of these poems and come away with the idea that she's a bit of a shrew. Why on earth is Spenser pursuing such a grouchy woman? I think to do so, though, is rather unfair. She often provides a pragmatic corrective to his wilder fancies. Perhaps she's cautious, perhaps conservative, wary of daring to dream the florid dreams of her wooer. But she's not cruel. And when Spenser does refer to her more bristly moods, one gets the sense that he's aware of his own desperation for her, and he knows that shades his interpretation of her behavior. And let's remember that amoretti means little intimacies. We should think of these sonnets as very private moments between two people who are fully open to each other, who know how to situate whatever extra-lingual cues might be implied in the verse. You don't believe me? Okay, look, just go back to Sonnet 75, or look at Sonnet 79 and read them imagining a teasing, playful tone. Totally works. Totally works. In fact, I think it makes those poems even more intriguing. Perhaps at the remove of 400 plus years, we too easily find the old language kind of automatically formal and grave. It's maybe easy to forget that people had a laugh even back then. And if we read them in that way, a little bit playful, a little bit teasing, then we easily understand the happy ending that Spenser gives us in a poem called Epithalamion. Now, that word comes from the Greek, and it means something like at the bedroom door. An epithalamion is a wedding poem. I told you it all worked out. Classical epithalamions do have a somewhat formal structure. They begin with an invocation of the muse, they move on to describe the bridal procession. Then we get the religious rites, followed by the wedding party. Finally, the poem concludes with the preparations for the wedding night and, tastefully implied, consummation. Again, Spencer takes a traditional form and innovates. Here, he is both poet and bridegroom, not merely the guest observer. The poem contains 365 long lines, as well as some shorter ones, one for each day of the year, and he's got 24 stanzas, one for each hour of the day. Specifically, he's got 16 daylight stanzas and 8 nighttime stanzas. And he also employs a refrain, some variation of the first stanza's concluding line, quote, "The woods shall to me answer and my echo ring." And a version of that line ends each of the remaining stanzas, and they subtly modulate the meaning each time. I like the echo in the refrain. That's great. Yet despite the happy celebrations, the wonderful descriptions of her beauty, still we sense Spencer's anxiety about the passing of time. On the one hand, the groom has the quite understandable yearning for the night to come. Quote, "Ah, when will this long, weary day have end, and lend me leave to come unto my love? How slowly do the hours their numbers spend, how slowly does sad time his feathers move." But on the other hand, the poem ends with a prayer to the gods. Quote, "Pour out your blessing on us plenteously, and happy influence upon us rain, that we may raise a large posterity which from the earth, which they may long possess with lasting happiness." You needn't pray for posterity and lasting happiness unless you anxiously recognize their temporality, their finiteness. We all know this, right? The week goes by so slowly, the weekend so quickly. We anticipate and we dread. We even have this idea in our traditional wedding vows, "Till death us do part." Wow! Right at the beginning of the most deeply intimate and eternal relationship human beings can have, we are reminded that we will die. That's what happens, though, when, like Spencer, you seek to imbue your poetry with some flesh and blood actuality. Beatrice and Laura and Stella are, in the final analysis, abstractions, projections of Dante's and Petrarch's and Sidney's aspirations and desires. Even Wyatt's Anne Boleyn, if I can be so liberal with my interpretation, eventually becomes a prism through which he studies himself. But Spencer blurs the boundary between self and speaker. He gives his Elizabeth a recognizable, round, and complex character. He gives her a humanity not abstracted. And so, I think we can see Edmund Spencer as a synthetic poet, the new poet he wanted to be. And by synthetic, I don't mean artificial. I mean blending, combining, synthesizing. He looks back to Chaucer for a traditional, pure language. He imitates Theocritus and Virgil. But he imbues those classical and medieval traditions with a modern, humanistic sensibility. We'll talk more about this in our next episode on Spencer, in which we'll have a look at his masterpiece, the epic Faery Queen. Now, if you like to read along, let me suggest that you focus on book one of the poem, the story of Red Cross the Knight, and maybe have a look at what are called the mutability cantos. Given the massiveness of this work, I'm probably going to focus on those two sections, okay? All right. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you real soon.